Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassai and I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, retired citizens get together in Prince Edward County. They're working on the Love Song Seniors Housing Project.
I've had old ladies grab me by the arm and say, Ken, when will this project be done? Will it be done before I die?
The Sunny Bray Farm, founded in BC back in 1888, is still going strong and having the best blueberry season ever.
My friends were going to Disneyland and doing stuff like that, and I was coming up here having a far greater adventure. I just always loved that stuff. It was just in my blood.
The Nova Scotia government is spending $102 million on the expansion of the IWK Emergency Care Department in Halifax.
We are working actively now on operational redesigns to sort of prepare us for the new department, and as well as to hopefully improve wait times.
A Korean artist in Sackville, New Brunswick is brewing up some rice wine for our Bubble Burn Gather event at the Sackville Community Garden.
It's kind of a living being. It takes 2 to 3 weeks to ferment. Once you bottle it, you wait or day or two before you drink it.
And the Heritage Abbotsford Society in BC has announced that it will restore the 145-year-old Turner House and is in need of forgotten skills to get the project rolling. Welcome to Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Well, there's a cool project in the works in Picton, Ontario. Retired citizens got together and are now trying to finance and build 50 affordable housing units for seniors. They call their project the Love Song Seniors Housing. The affordable housing development is looking to convert the defunct Pinecrest Memorial Elementary School in Bloomfield into rental units. And it's more than just an affordable place to stay on the 20-acre property they bought. Organizers hope to make it a $14 million communal living project. This is in response to a need for affordable seniors housing in the county, as the wait list for existing lower rent residences has grown to 4 years. Alexander Wright is in Picton, Ontario. He spoke to Love Song board members Donna Rogers and Ken Howe.
Organizers behind the Love Song Seniors Housing Initiative are now reporting that they are in the final stages of financing for Phase 1. The affordable housing development, which seeks to convert the defunct Pinecrest Memorial Elementary School in Bloomfield, will create 50 affordable rental units while applying the Danish co-housing communal living model, a novel concept in Canada. Features will include a library, makerspace, gymnasium, licensed kitchen, walking trails, and carbon-neutral status solar power. This is in response to the pressing need for affordable seniors housing in the county, as the waitlist for existing lower-rent residences has grown to 4 years. Love Song board members Donna Rogers and Ken Howe report that an application for a federal Green and Inclusive Community Buildings GICB grant has been submitted, and Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation CMHC financing is in process for a combined total of $14 million. As well, they had these words to share concerning their journey thus far.
And we've had a lot
of
vote support, unanimous, every time we made a request to council for cutbacks in water costs and for agreement to financially support this and so on and so on. So it's been really a great thing. I can't be negative about it in that regard. I'm frustrated, no question, that the powers-to-be government have not said, oh, that sounds like a great... What we have had is comments like, well, you guys are beginning swimmers in a pool against Olympic class athletes. Sad stories. I've had old ladies grab me by the arm and say, Ken, when will this project be done? Will it be done before I die? Asking that question. Seeing the building or seeing the model, seeing the video, will it be done before I die? Then you ask me that same question. Why are you doing this? Or why isn't other people doing it?
We are doing it because we're retired and we are our brother's keeper. And if we don't do it, who's going to do it?
Love Song organizers expect Phase 1 construction to take 1 year once they are approved for financing. They also plan multiple additional phases on the 20-acre property in the future. For the Local Journalism Initiative, this is Alex Wright.
You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
We now travel out west to Cortis Island, BC, where journalist Craig Osoba had a great time visiting the 134-year-old Sunny Bray Farm. This historic farm had one of its best growing seasons to date, even if it faced many challenges during the harvest. The Sunnybrae Farm was founded in 1888 by Scotsman John Manson, one of the first Europeans to settle on Cortes Island. The farm has remained in the Manson family through the generations and is now owned and operated by John Manson's grandson, Mike Manson. He inherited the property back in 1963 at a very young age. The farm achieved heritage status from the BC government in 2013 and is now known primarily for its blueberry production. Greg Osoba learned more about the legacy, pleasures, and challenges of operating Sunnybrae Farm as he walked through the farm with the owner, Mike Manson.
Heritage Certified Sunnybrae Farm was established by John Manson in 1888 after he arrived from the Shetland Islands in Scotland. He was one of the first Europeans to settle on Cortes Island. His grandson, Mike Manson, says he has the farming genes. After working as a survey engineer, Manson and his family returned to live on and work the farm 11 years ago. The farm is known for its blueberry production, and Manson says this year was one of the best on record, with a million berries picked. However, he says it wasn't easy finding help to get the job done, and an unexpected group of pickers has come forward, senior citizens. Manson adds that when the farm was first established, it was much larger than present day, and though much smaller, he wants to ensure it stays in his family.
The original property was quite a bit bigger than what we have today. Today we have 14 acres, but when he first came, he preempted 115 acres, which today was the land bounded by Highfield and the seascape, a big triangle, if you will.
Now, as we take a little stroll around the property here, what is it that you actually raise on Sunnybrae Farm at this point, Mike?
I think we're best known for our blueberry. We've been growing blueberries since, in a commercial way, probably since about 1994. We planted them in 1984, and it took a few years to get them going, and we had to learn a lot of stuff. It wasn't just magic production. So that's been our mainstay. Certainly, I think we're known far and wide for our blueberries. But since we moved here full-time 11 years ago, we now raise sheep. And last 3-4 years, we've been raising a few hogs in the summer with Jenny Hartwick. And we have chickens and eggs, chickens and ducks. We sell a few eggs, but it's hardly a commercial venture, that part.
What has been the various types of way this land has been farmed over those generations since 1888?
My grandfather, obviously, he was his primary income. He was a farmer, for sure. And he raised a lot of sheep, which he sold to logging camps. He grew a lot of apples. And we know from his records, he grew a lot of potatoes, and all of which went to logging camps, a ready market. There was a big demand. He certainly grew other stuff. We've seen notes in his ledger books selling eggs. I know he had quite a few eggs at one time, but sheep, potatoes, and apples, I would say, were his mainstay.
And then you guys moved to blueberries. I see that you still got an active orchard here as well.
Oh, yeah, we got lots of fruit trees. I think today we got over 100 fruit trees. Some are in good production, others are in lesser. But everybody's got apples. We've switched to pears, about 20 pear trees, because pears are obviously a little more rare, I think, than an apple. And there's some good varieties these days of pears. But again, we're using those more for our own consumption. We sell some apples, but not many.
Do folks have any kind of a farming philosophy when it comes to Sunnybrae's production or how you grow things? And
we practice organic methods. We're not certified. Some of the organizations, like it's IOPA, and I don't know if it's OMRI, but we're not registered as such. But certainly we definitely practice organic methods. We don't spray herbicides, pesticides, fungicides. We do spray our blueberries, but that's with a biofungicide, which is an organic solution to a nasty pest we have. But yeah, we're definitely organic. We've learned that. And I think what I've realized is everybody suggests organic is this new fad. But in fact, organic has been, that was the start years ago. It's just been a brief time since maybe possibly after World War I or something, when there was a surplus of nitrates and fertilizers, that farmers started using this stuff for fertilizer. But a lot of people are going back to what was really the original thing anyhow. The organic thing is just a natural way of growing.
Yeah, it's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years.
It has, and it's a bit of a revelation. It's not always obvious to people. I know for me it wasn't for a long time. It's like, oh yeah, this new organic philosophy. And one night it just sunk in, hey, wait a minute, we've been doing this forever. And I think with the sheep and all the manure, Maybe that drives the point home more. You're not buying bag fertilizer or anything. You've got your fertilizer right there.
Yeah, Mike, you mentioned that you and your wife and family moved back here for 11 years ago. What was it that drew you back to the family farm?
I was always a farmer. I think I tell people I have the farmer gene. As a little boy when we come up here, probably when I was about six, so probably earliest memories, 62, 63. I was greatly taken by Cortez. He had outhouses, great big barns. There was guns, there was double bit axes, there was just stuff that wasn't in the city. My friends were going to Disneyland and doing stuff like that, and I was coming up here having a far greater adventure. I just always loved that stuff. It was just in my blood. And as if to cement that dream, in 1963, for reasons I don't know exactly, the farm was left to me by my late Uncle Jack. So in 1963, the farm was left to me, at that young age, it certainly didn't mean much. But over the years, that concept carved its way into my brain in stone, I would say, or it's etched in my DNA today.
Wow. And as far as the current farming season went, 2022, two things. Number one, just curious how it all went. And secondly, we're experiencing these drought conditions on the coast right now. We can't seem to predict weather. It's all changing as we move forward. Did you guys suffer at all with the lack of water this?
I don't think we suffered. The trees now are hurting, but our blueberries are in an old swamp. We would have been in big trouble if we had to irrigate them, which we can't. They were planted in the swamp. We drained the swamp. Ken Hansen helped us drain it with dynamite, and that was in 1984. And so we've always had water for the berries, including this year. They thrive. For us, I'd say drought, not a condition. The sheep might be a bit hungrier, but that can be fixed with money by buying more hay.
And just in terms of production and stuff, as far as the blueberry season went, how was that this year?
This year's season was good. It was actually on a per bush basis. It was the best year, or equal to the best year we've ever had. We've had years where we've had far more numbers of berries in, but at that time we had more bushes. So we're fewer bushes, but per capita, if you can say that, the quota per bush was the highest it's ever been this year.
Okay. Now, I know that we had discussed quite some time ago, though, you were affected by the labor shortage that's hitting just about everywhere and any sector of business. Was that the case? And if so, how difficult was that for you?
Labor is an issue. Labor is a huge issue, and it snuck up on us. We never really saw it. For years and years, we've had kids contact us in the spring looking for a blueberry job, all excited, young kids, 10, 11, 12. But the last couple of years, the kids, it's partly demographics, and it's partly other businesses are feeling the pinch for workers and are, in my estimation, offering wages that are pretty high for young 12, 13-year-old kids, and so it lures them away. And I think times have changed, too. I think young people now have money. Kids today aren't as keen on the dollar as I would say I am, or my generation was. It is a challenge. We did good this year. By luck, and I don't like going luck. I like to plan. With a background in engineering, it's all about planning and understanding what's going on. But we got lucky. Visitors to the island, friends of friends who had kids that were really keen to pick, and boy, oh boy, they showed up and they filled the spaces. We did well, and we've got a crew of seniors now, which is really cool. I'm thinking maybe that's the future. It's a social outing for them. There's a little bit more money there, maybe if they need it, and it's fun. It's a beautiful place, the blueberries. So we are looking at something different with the labor, for sure. And it's not hard work, but you need many hands. This year we picked over 1 million berries. So,
and Mike, do you have the future plans for Sunny Bray Farm, or do you have a vision for anything, or just like status quo, or what are you feeling about the future?
Oh gosh, future. Yeah, I'm getting to the age I got to start thinking about the future. My son is busy in Victoria with his life and career, and not sure that he's got the farmer gene, but it's our hope that he'll continue, I call it the legacy of my grandfather. And this is our 134th year on this land, which is, I think, unusual for many people to be in one spot for a long time. So it is special in ways that are difficult to perhaps share or describe to other people. But I do hope my son will be able to get here in some form at some time. I think we're becoming a bit of a dinosaur to have a large piece of land on the real estate, or real estate on the water. I inherited it at age 7, but I always thought of myself as a meat and potatoes kid, and now I've got this great big piece of land, but it's certainly not something I want to sell for money. I think we've done a good job looking after this piece of land, and anybody could have done that, but we did it, and I would like to see it continued if I could. be like a private park almost. It's a chunk of land that's looked after and public can count on it. But that's rather heady words, I think. Who knows where it's going to turn out.
You're on the air with Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
The construction of a new pediatric emergency department is currently underway at the IWK Health Center in Halifax, Nova Scotia. The Nova Scotia government is spending $102 million on the project. The expansion should better enable the IWK to provide emergency care and to accommodate a greater number of complex cases. The construction of the IWK new pediatric emergency department began earlier this month and is expected to be completed in 2025. Sarah Gouda is in Halifax, Nova Scotia. She spoke to Rebecca DeChamplain, the clinical lead for IWK's emergency department redevelopment.
Hello, Rebecca. How are you doing today?
Hi, thank you.
How long has the planning been in place for this new department, and how will that help solve the issue of patients' long waiting patient times?
Yeah, those are two sort of separate but related questions. So we've been planning on working actively on the design of the department since 2019. And there had been work prior to that on studying projections for emergency department usage at the IWK for years to come. So that work had already happened prior to 2019 when we actually started to design. So there are folks who look at department utilization. So who's using the department, what types of patients, how many patients, times a day, times of year, all that kind of stuff goes into sort of big calculations and projections on what the population growth would be and all that stuff to look at what type of emergency department services do we need to have in Halifax for the next generation to come. So that work, a lot of that work had already happened prior to 2019 when we started actually designing the department. And so we do hope, I think the public is well aware that there are issues in emergency departments with wait times. That's something that has probably always been the case and is maybe getting a little bit worse in recent times. We do hope that a new emergency department will help improve those wait times. It isn't the only piece of the problem, though, and so I think that's important to talk about what we are doing also in the meantime, both to address waiting issues right now and to prepare ourselves for working in the new department in the future. So just building a bigger department won't necessarily improve wait times. In fact, a bigger space could actually make things less efficient if we're not working in, if we don't have the design that's it takes into consideration the way people use the department, the way staff work, so that we can work more efficiently in the department. So we are working actively now on operational redesigns to sort of prepare us for the new department and as well as to hopefully improve wait times. Our hopes would be to get a lot of involvement from the community on how they would like to see the new department look and what kind of aspects are important to them to be included in the new department. There's still time, even though some of the design is certain phases of it have been completed. There is still lots of opportunity for people to give some involvement and to let us know what kinds of things are important to them, both for the care that they're receiving currently, as well as for what they would like to see in the new department. I feel like the kids that come and use our department are the best people to help us plan for the future. But you will see us making quality improvements. We are working on increasing efficiency, bringing in new equipment, new protocols into place in our current department right now.
Artist in residence and curator Myung Soon Kim has been brewing up more than an exhibit in Sackville, New Brunswick. Myung Soon Kim spent a couple of weeks at the Struts Gallery preparing to host Sackvillians at the Bubble Burn Gather Rituals for Belonging event, which was presented at the Sackville Community Garden. But the event also featured the sharing of Magali, which she made herself. Makgeolli is a Korean fermented rice wine. Kim has been making Makgeolli in part as a way of reconnecting with the history of her Korean background, some of which is not written in history books. Journalist Erica Butler wanted to know more about the drink and what it means to the artist. She met up with her close to the tracks.
So Makgeolli is a fermented Korean rice wine. The recipe is quite youngish. It's about 200 years, and half of the time it was in prohibition through Japanese occupation, and then it's Korean War and military dictatorship, and throughout various decades of that time, there was a prohibition. So anyone found making any part of this would have been in prison and, you know, suffer persecution. But I saw these documentaries where they actually show these bunkers that were remained from back in the day, and in the middle of a forest they dug a hole to make parts of this. So one of the most important part is nuruk. Nuruk is like it's grain-based mold that essentially breaks down other grains. So the mold needs to be activated in order for the rice grain to break down. And it needs 38 to 42 degrees Celsius and incredible humidity in, of course, sterile environment to produce this mold. So they were building these bunkers in order to be able to produce the mold. The grain itself used to be rice-based, but now it's wheat-based after Korean War, as wheat became very accessible through, like, the trades. Yeah.
And so you've been brewing this Makgeolli, like, the whole time you've been in residence here?
Yes, I have. So I gathered all the material. It took me about a week to gather right the vessels, and there's been some experimentation in terms of, like, the shape of the vessel. One of the... Hello, train.
We're getting all the Sackville noises today.
Yeah, it's very inclusive. It's funny because I was like thinking how Makgeolli responds to rice. Yeah, rice mine making, there's seven factors, and one of them is air. So I feel like it's signaling this noise. Really going for that.
You really gotta toot that horn.
One of the staff at Strutt, Simone, lent me their grandmother's heirloom, and it's the ceramic vessel that the grandmother used to make plum wine in. And so using, it was very generous of them to lend it to me, and so I'm fermenting it, and it seems to be fermenting very well, the rice wine. So every day for 2 to 3 weeks, I'm stirring it every few hours. And so that the rice doesn't, because it's heavy, it doesn't settle to the bottom, and then they can breathe. So it's kind of a living being. It takes 2 to 3 weeks to ferment. Once you bottle it, you wait a day or two before you drink it. Every day for the next 3 weeks, which is sort of like the prime time to drink it, it changes. It continues to ferment. It's a spirit that stays living, and every day it transforms and becomes more effervescent, and it's, yeah, really time thing. There are stabilized versions that you could probably find in an alcohol store, but those things are treated with a lot of preservatives, so it doesn't quite taste the same. So it's meant to be living. It's meant to be this living spirit that you enjoy for the moment, and a lot of work.
Yeah, it sounds like it. How does this Makgeolli, like, interplay with your work as an artist? Like,
I was, when I started to think about my own background and Korean lineage, and there's a lot of silent history that I didn't really know about growing up that I was discovering, and a lot of it was also in the food and the evolution of the food. And when I started making Makgeolli in particular, it gave me access to elders who carry these stories that were never published, or, you know, it wasn't in any of the literature that I found. What I realized is that because Makgeolli, when you hand make it in the way that it's supposed to, and you don't taste any of the preservatives, it brought them memory and it brought them friends. And so it's kind of, for me, a way to carry my ancestors with me in the places I go, but also be able to share it with other people. So it's been a real privilege to be able to share that, and for to hear some of these stories from elders.
A A 145-year-old heritage home will be restored for Claiborn Park. The Heritage Abbotsford Society has announced that it will restore the Turner House, a historic residence in the city. The Turner House was relocated to Claiborn Park several years ago in British Columbia. Once the restoration is complete, it will serve the community as part of Claiborn Park's new developments. Work on the project began in mid-October and will continue for several years. The restoration is part of a collaborative project with the city of Abbotsford that invites secondary and post-secondary students and community members to participate in webinars, workshops, and hands-on classes on the restoration of heritage homes. Executive Director of Heritage Abbotsford, Christina Reed, spoke with our journalist Stephen Munga about the holistic approach they plan to take with the restoration and the history of the Turner House.
A lot of times people think that a heritage home is a building that's old, but actually a heritage building can be something that's relatively new. A heritage building is a building that has cultural significance to the community. So Turner House is actually the oldest still in use building in Abbotsford. It's a really interesting project because it starts back in the 1870s, where Alban Hawkins, who was a retired Royal Engineer, wrote in his diary about assisting Mr. Turner in building his home. So Turner House was built on the highest point on the Matsqui Flats. This is not an empty prairie that we're looking at or anything like that. This is the traditional ancestral and unceded territory of the Stalo. It's interesting looking at these diaries because he writes about getting help in building Turner House by the indigenous population as well, and he actually names them in his diaries. So knowing about all of this, we have a problem though, and that's where this project comes in. The trades, the skills that you need to restore a building that's a very old building, whether it's an indigenous longhouse or a modern office building, are not necessarily taught in schools, because a heritage building is always greener. It takes upwards of 50 to 60 years for a new build to catch up to the carbon footprint of a building like Trithewey House or Turner House or South Poplar. So what we're going to do is we're going to go beyond that and replace with green product. We need to teach people how to do weaving, blacksmithing, pollarding, all kinds of things that you might need to actually restore a building.
That's it for us at Viewpoints. Our collaborators this week, Erica Butler, Sarah Gouda, Alexander Wright, Craig Osoba, and Stephen Munga. Our national coordinator, Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in Ottawa. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Please tune in to all our stories at canada-info.ca. Nice to have you with us. Take care. See you next week.